From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, when I was a novice back in ancient times, I picked up a little receiver, and it was advertised as being able to receive everything. All right? Everything.
All at the same time.
Oh, well, that was the problem. It wasn't false advertising, by golly. It really received everything at the same time. And it gave me a painful introduction to the necessity of filtering. And that's what we're going to talk about today, right?
Exactly.
All kinds of filters. Where do we start, though?
Well, let's start with receivers. We could talk about transmitters and receivers because they both use filters, but particularly when we get into sideband transmitters. But I think receivers are a good place to start with. And basically, the function of filters is to limit the bandwidth of a signal. And in the case you're talking about, what you want to do is you want to limit it to a single signal, usually, so you can hear that one and are not interfered with by other ones.
Right.
And how do you decide how wide it should be? Well, in the optimum situation, the receive filter bandwidth should match that of the bandwidth of the transmitted signal. And if that's the case, then you have kind of, you can optimize the signal-to-noise ratio because receiving system is proportional, directly proportional to bandwidth.
Right.
So if the filter is wider than the signal you want to receive, you get more noise, but you don't get more signal. So you want to generally have the two pretty close together. Now, you can go the other way. You can reduce the bandwidth to narrower than the transmitted signal, and you get less noise, but you also get less signal. But sometimes that's a reasonable compromise because you might not need to hear all of the spectrum of the transmitted signal to understand it. And if you have interference or noise, it might work better to actually reduce it below that. But the general starting point should be matching the bandwidth of the receiver to the transmitted bandwidth.
Well, single sideband would be a good example of that. You can reduce the filtering on a single sideband signal considerably and still understand what's being said.
That's true. I mean, the downside of that is if you go below the bandwidth that's being transmitted, some of the power of the transmitted signal is being wasted, not receiving it. So the best thing to do is get the other person to also reduce his transmit bandwidth so all his power is into the bandwidth that you're listening to. That's a little tricky to do, but conceptually it could be done. And the bandwidth that's needed is a function of the modulation type. So, for example, starting at the top, a VHF or UHF FM voice signal needs about 12 or 15 kilohertz of bandwidth, depending on the settings and so forth. That's about as wide as you get. A amateur AM signal is best received through a 6 to 8 kilohertz wide filter to receive both sidebands, but it can be received just on one side or the other with a 3 or 4 kilohertz signal as well.
Now, would that also be true, incidentally, of people that like to listen to AM shortwave broadcast?
That's true, yes. Generally, again, because you get the full power and so forth, if there's not interference or heavy noise, you're better off receiving both sidebands and getting the full benefit of what's transmitted, and they actually kind of add together in the receiver. But if there's interference on one side or the other, by switching to a narrower bandwidth filter, you can sometimes understand the signal better because you eliminate the interference. But I think generally the signal-to-noise ratio actually is somewhat degraded. Is that true? If you can hear the whole thing, you're better off listening to the full bandwidth of both sidebands.
Well, that makes sense, yeah.
But actually in some amateur equipment, for example, the famous KWS-1 single sideband transmitter, the first 1957 Collins sideband transmitter, actually sent AM by just sending one sideband and the carrier.
Oh, really?
It used the same sideband filter, but it just introduced the carrier. So it was sort of single sideband AM, if you will.
Hmm.
And that worked fine, too. So, you know, it works. As I say, the early Collins gear used a 3.1 kilohertz transmit filter, and the first Collins sideband receivers, the 75A4, also had a 3.1 kilohertz sideband filter. And that was, I think that came from the telephone company experience, because the typical toll quality, the quality of a commercial telephone circuit. We used a bandwidth of about that, usually 300 to 3300, about 3 kilohertz or a little more of bandwidth, which the Bell Telephone Company, Bell Labs people decided was adequate for voice. Now, the unfortunate thing about that was, of course, those guys were all, any picture you saw of them, they had big gray beards. And so their higher register hearing wasn't that great, and they weren't...
like mine.
They weren't young folks with high voices. So for that, that's one of the reasons why we can't always hear our grandchildren on the phone so well, because of the Bell Labs folks who decided 3 kilohertz was enough. Nor can you play the violin well over the phone. Now, no. That's not a problem for ham radio. But so the bandwidth kind of reduced over time as people realized you didn't really need all of that bandwidth for good quality single sideband work. The Collins, later Collins equipment, the transceivers tended to use a 2.1 kilohertz sideband filter. So the coverage, the frequency spectrum would be typically from 300 hertz to 2400 hertz. So 2.1 kilohertz above the start of the bandwidth. And some other manufacturers use wider filters up to, say, 2.7 kilohertz typically. So that's about what you see today, with more towards the lower end of that range. And then we come to CW and digital modes. And many people, in fact, the early transceivers used the same filter for sideband as for CW. But that's really not as good, because the CW really only needs 200, 300, 400 hertz is plenty of bandwidth for a CW signal. The problem with that is the tuning rate has to be very slow. Otherwise, as you go, if you tune past a very narrow bandwidth, when somebody has the key up, you won't hear them.
You go zip, 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 zip. Yeah,
you won't even know they're there. So it requires a very slow tuning rate. So I like to use, if it's not heavy interference, I like to use 500 hertz or so, sometimes even wider, just for casual listening. But once the interference comes up, I just crank it down. Once you have the station tuned in, you can cut it down to 100 or even 50 hertz, get rid of the interference, and improve the signal-to-noise ratio. As we said, the received noise is proportional to the bandwidth. So the difference between a 200 hertz CW filter and using a 2.1 kilohertz sideband filter for CW is a bandwidth factor of more than 10, and that is a results in a 10 dB improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. So the signal is still the same strength in that narrow filter, but you have reduced by 90% the noise that your receiver is receiving. So if it's a weak signal, reducing the bandwidth makes a big difference in how well you can hear it. So that's particularly important for people in moon bounce and VHF weak signal operation, where signals tend to be very weak sometimes, and make a big difference.
Absolutely.
Some of the digital modes have their own filtering built into the digital processing.
Yes.
So you talk, you know, the PSK and so forth use it actually a narrower bandwidth, even though you look at it on a computer with a wider bandwidth so you can see all the signals. When you actually process the signal in your sound card, the processing actually effectively reduces the bandwidth to match that that's being sent. And again, if you have interference, even though you might start with a matched filtering situation on sideband, if you crank it in from the edges or slide one way or the other, you can eliminate some interference. You're reducing the signal and the noise together, but if you still have enough signal so that you can copy it, you typically have comparable signal-to-noise ratio, but a much better signal-to-interference ratio, because you get rid of the interference on one side or the other. So some receivers have what Collins originally called passband tuning, which they did manually or mechanically in the 75A4 receiver, but it now is done using digital signal processing, where you can move the window of the bandwidth back and forth, or some transceivers allow you to move the edges in from either the top or the bottom and pick the portion of the channel that you want to receive to get the best signal results through interference.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, Joel, let's take a quick break, hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
I'll be here.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime, and we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. As long as we're talking about filters, I wanted to differentiate between IF filters and AF filters for those who maybe are not familiar.
Okay, well, that's a good topic to bring up, because what we've talked about so far didn't really distinguish where in the system we were doing the filter.
Exactly, right.
And you could actually do it anywhere in the system. The difference is that the closer you do it to where the signal comes in the receiver, the better off you are generally. And the reason is that if you get rid of signals you don't want before they get into the processing within the receiver, you don't have the artifacts that show up due to nonlinearities in the receiver. We've all seen the QST product reviews, which talks about intermodulation, distortion, third-order IMD response, and so forth. Well, what happens is if you have multiple signals in your receiver and you have nonlinearities in some of the stages, they actually can do mixing and result in mixing products that generate signals, interfering signals within your receiver.
Yes.
So if the signal is generated within your receiver, you can't get rid of it in front of that because it's happening inside the receiver. What you have to do is limit the extraneous signals from getting into that part of the circuitry in the first place. And the best way to do that is close to the antenna. So typically, in many receivers, this is actually divided up. You have what's called a roofing filter early that gets rid of signals that are fairly close to the desired passband.
Why is it called a roofing filter, by the way?
Well, it keeps the rain out, I guess. I don't know. It sets the bandwidth of the signals that enter into the processing realm of the receiver. And it used to be they were typically made wide enough to pass any of the signals you might want to listen to. So it used to be they'd often be like 15 kilohertz, which would pass FM or AM or single sideband or CW. And then once you got into the place where you're actually doing the processing, signal processing, you'd eliminate it down to what you really wanted to hear. And people found after a while that there were enough extra signals getting into that 15 kilohertz that if you let those signals into the processing area, that's where you got into trouble. Particularly with the advent of the digital signal processing, in which you would hit a analog to digital converter. And that has a limited amount of dynamic range. So if you come in too strongly into that, it'll no longer digitize properly, and it'll generate some of these artifacts. It can also happen in analog stages as well, and used to in many cases. And people didn't realize it, that some of the signals that were interfering with their reception were generated inside their receiver. So by making the roofing filter closer to the receive bandwidth, you actually do a lot better job at getting rid of these products that are in the receiver itself. So that's the idea of the roofing filter. So generally, most systems have filtering at a couple levels. So you have a filter that gets rid of the undesired signals that are near the one you're listening to. And then nowadays, when you get into the digital signal processing, which used to be at AF and is now at IF largely, you actually get down to the very narrow or whatever adjustable bandwidth, 50 hertz steps or something that we take for granted in our newer equipment. So that's where you set the so-called operating bandwidth, and that always has to be less than the roofing filter, less than or equal to the roofing filter bandwidth. And whether that happens at IF or AF doesn't matter. Once you get rid of all these extraneous things, you have, if you have a linear system, you can do it any place in the system. You could even do it in your earphones.
Well, I was going to ask about that. Now, thinking of QRP kit type radios, oftentimes they don't have a lot of filtering. So hams will buy external audio filters to try to basically extract the signal that they're listening to. You don't see them as much anymore. But how effective are those really?
Well, if it's a digital audio filter, a DSP-based audio filter, it can be just as sharp as an IF filter. One problem with the QRP radios is a lot of them that use direct conversion receivers listen or get to hear both sides of the zero beat on a CW signal. So that effectively makes twice as many CW signals. It's a little bit of a different kind of problem. That was a problem that was solved by a guy named Lamb, I think, in the 1930s, using a crystal filter to get rid of the other side of zero beat. And all of a sudden, there were half as many signals in the receiver, which was a real plus. It's called single signal reception. That's kind of step one. You've got to have selectivity enough that'll just get one side of the zero beat on a CW signal, or you have twice as many signals, which is not the end of the world if you're just casually talking to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the benefits of early transceivers was the designs were such that I used the same VFO for both transmit and receive, which was a big plus, but because the early crystal and mechanical filters were quite expensive, you could actually use the same filter for both transmit and receive. And if everybody used the same brand of equipment, then you were sort of guaranteed having a matched bandwidth.
Yes.
But of course, not everybody does.
No,
but
no.
Anyway, but it's the same sort of idea. Transceiver or sideband transmitters are basically receivers running backwards, sort of, with the stages all turned around, but basically use the same oscillators and so forth. Gets a little trickier in CW.
Well, since we've been talking about the stages of receivers, I thought this might be an appropriate question for you, Joel.
Okay.
This is from Jim, WA3ERQ, and he's asking, why is a super heterodyne receiver called super? I understand what heterodyne is, but I don't understand the super part. Just because it's a darn good receiver, right?
Yeah, right. Well, it was pretty super for compared to other things. But some people might not know about the heterodyne part. So let's go back a little bit to before super heterodynes. And before super heterodynes, what happened was there was no conversion at all in a receiver. You basically brought the signal in from the antenna. You amplified it a number of times at the frequency that you were listening to, which, if you think about it, is a little tricky because each one of the stages needs to be tuned when you're doing it in that realm. And some of the receivers had a whole bunch of dials on the front, and you had to change each one of them to put them all on the same frequency. Typically, three was the one you'd see the most, but there are receivers with more than three knobs on them. And of course, what that meant is you couldn't just tune around to find a signal. You had to know what frequency you were looking for and then put all the dials on the same spot, and then you'd detect it and then have an audio amplifier after it. That was called a tuned radio frequency receiver, TRF receiver. And they're actually still used sometimes in the microwave region.
Yes, they are.
But for most receiver purposes that amateurs use, it's no longer frequently encountered. After the multiple dial kind of thing, somebody figured out, well, we could, instead of putting them all next to each other, we could put them behind each other and have them all connected together. So we have one big knob and a lot of bearings, and we turn all of these variable capacitors together and shift all of these tuned circuits at the same time, which sounds straightforward. It is quite tricky to make them all actually tuned at the same place at the same time. It requires some heavy-duty alignment and clever design. And then there are all kinds of technical issues about tuning rate and actually the bandwidth that results, because the lower frequency signals tend to have a narrower bandwidth than the higher frequency signals. So the sound sounds different at one end of the broadcast band than the other, and you know, all kinds of issues. So that was a fundamental limitation of early vacuum tube receivers that had amplifiers. I mean, that still was a lot better than receivers that didn't have amplifiers, which is what we had to deal with before. The solution was initially attributed to Major Edwin Armstrong in 1917, when we don't think of vacuum tubes that much, but he was actually an Army officer. He was working on a radio direction finder system for the Army, and that's where this idea of heterodyning came in. It turned out, actually, a French engineer by the name of Lucien Levé independently invented it a few months earlier, and he ended up owning the patent. But the idea was, instead of amplifying all the signals or all stages at the same frequency, you'd bring the signal in from the antenna, you'd mix it or heterodyne it with a locally generated oscillator, and end up with a signal translated to an intermediate frequency. And then you could amplify that intermediate frequency as many times as you wanted, and that didn't have to change, because to change receive signals, you'd just change the frequency of the local oscillator, and that would heterodyne a different signal into that IF range. And that worked very well. Now, the thing was, in those days, they really had a lot of trouble with the old triode tubes of the 20s and 30s making stable radio frequency amplifiers. They were hard to keep from oscillating and so forth, and it took a lot of low-gain stages to do much. But they were pretty good at audio amplifiers.
Mm-hmm.
So the early intermediate frequency ranges that were used were in the tens of kilohertz, which was what was then called supersonic. I guess it still is called supersonic. So super heterodyne is a contraction of supersonic heterodyne. That's where the super comes from.
I had no idea.
I didn't either. I had to look that up. I thought it was an interesting question. Because I just took, you know, that's what it is. It's a super het. Okay, got it. Thank you. But this is why it's a super het. And of course, you know, after a while, the normal IF frequency for most broadcast receivers ended up at 455 kilohertz, some up and down a little bit from that, which is up into the range that was RF at the time that they were doing this. But interestingly, in the 50s, when single sideband came along, many of the receivers went back to a multiple conversion scheme and did the selectivity back at 50 kilohertz or 85 kilohertz or 100 kilohertz. So they actually went back to supersonic range frequencies. The Drake, my Drake C-line.
I was going to bring up the Drake, yeah.
Did that. Well, in fact, almost everybody did a similar thing. Hallicrafters with their SX-101 and SX-100 before that had a multiple conversion with, I think, around 100 kilohertz IF. National did a similar thing with the NC-300. That was kind of the best people could do until they came up with really good filters. First, Collins, the mechanical filter, and then crystal lattice filters at about the same time. And when they became able to do that at in the megahertz range, that made design of receivers a lot easier. But superhet meant supersonic heterodyne, and that's where it came from.
All right. Well, that's super, Joel. Oh,
Thank you. You're easy to please.
Thanks.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.